going on a low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. It feel like my life ain't mine. I've been on the low, I've been taking my time.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Project Mayday. These are your hosts, G and Bree, and today we have Tony Costa. He is a 39-year-old from Tucson, and he also works for Tucson Fire Department, 16 years of service. Before that, he was in the military in the Army for around 9 years and retired out as a specialist. This man's got an incredible story or stories from making decisions that didn't fit his moral high ground. But he had to make them, and then coming out and going into therapy and then coming out of therapy and going into the fire service. I mean, there's just so much that this guy's been through, and he's willing to share. So, Tony, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, buddy. Yeah, and right off the bat, the one thing that really spoke to me was your enlistment date is 9/11. Like the moment you started
boot camp,
basic training, it's 9/11/2001. Do you feel that there's a significance to that?
Foreshadowing.
Oh man, you know, I remember that morning sitting there at the station ready to get shipped off to basic training and just watching this happen on the news and thinking, oh man, what did I do?
And now I'm in a war.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I happened to miss Afghanistan just because I was still early on in my career. I think I just got back to basic training, been with my unit a couple months, and they had shipped some guys off. But I missed Afghanistan, but I was there and ready to ship when Iraq happened in 03. So, but yeah, that was the morning of September 11th was my first day of basic training.
Wow.
What was the conversation? Like, what were you guys saying? I mean, I'm sure the instructors had a whole different conversation, but what was, you guys, and, you know, mm-hmm. in going through basic training, like, what was the thought process? Mm-hmm. What was the conversation?
You know, I mean, they messed with us a little bit. They told us that, you know, we weren't even going to go to basic training. They're just going to give us weapons and ship us overseas, but it's not really happened, you know. And I spent that first day just glued to the TV watching it all unfold, you know. But as soon as we got there, I mean, we had no idea what was going on after that. I mean, it was straight to work and basic training. So mm-hmm. it wasn't until I finished basic training and went to my advanced individual training that, you know, I went back and kind of had seen what had played out over those first few months after September 11th.
So you said that you missed Afghanistan, but you went into Iraq. You had a deployment there. So because we're talking so much about your personal journey of mental wellness, can you talk about Iraq?
Okay. So I got notified the first week in February of 03 that I was being deployed. And, you know, this was back in 03. So there was no 90-day, you know, warning that we were being deployed. It was within, you know, when I picked up my orders, within 3 days, I was in Fort Lewis, Washington, out processing, and within a week, I was in a foreign country, you know.
Wow.
So that's a rule. That's a rule now that you have to have 90 days of notice?
My understanding, yeah, if you're going to be deployed anywhere, there's a 90-day window, yeah, from the time you tie or you pick up your orders to the time you go, but. Yeah, within a week or two, I was in a foreign country already. So, you know, I think I was 24, 25 at the time. So,
were you in the mindset of I'm doing it, like I'm in it?
Yeah, I mean, just shell shock. You know, mm-hmm. it's hard to describe. It's just, you know, you just pluck out of your everyday life, and now you're just it's surreal. Yeah.
Sure. So that whole kind of moral dilemma that I was talking about in your intro. Go into that a little bit.
Well, you know, I was raised Catholic, you know, went to Sunday school, went to church with my parents every Sunday and my siblings. And my dad's a man's man, you know, everything I learned from him. So he's just a great guy. And, so going to war, you know, there's that moral dilemma, you know, and you have chaplains to talk to you and tell you, you know, it's good good versus evil, or you're doing, you know, it's hard to justify the things that happen in war, you know, especially for someone like me. And I grew up a hunter, you know, me and my dad, we've hunted God our whole lives, and it's just different when it's a human being, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, go into that. You know, you and I have talked about, or us three have talked about, you know, the actual incident where it was challenged. Your moral compass was challenged. So, can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, you know, it was a 14-month deployment, and so much happened in those first, and it was the first 14 months of the war, so it was, you know what I mean, it was hell. But probably one of the first and most major incidents that really had an impact on me was early on in the war, and had to do with women and children, you know. And they would use them against us, you know, as human shields or as roadblocks and stuff to, you know, get us to stop so they can ambush the convoys and stuff. So, you know, being forced to do something you wouldn't normally do is where, you know, you get these moral injuries from. You know, it affects you. It affects everyone.
Yeah. So were you, you know, that when you were faced with that and you made the decision that you made, were you thinking about it for nights, you know, however many, you know, months, or was it actively on your mind?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I slept the first few nights after that. Mm-hmm. And just replaying that in my head over and over and over again, you know, asking those questions like, what could I have done different? Mm-hmm. Is there anything I could have done to avoid this? Or, and just really, you know, the guilt, and feeling guilty about what happened, and the images. Yeah, I mean, for probably weeks after that, you know, it affected me. And, you know, it's like one thing after another. So, you know, not too long after that, something else happened, mm-hmm. you know, and there's more images, and then there's, you know, more things to think about. And but that one was probably the one that stuck with me the most, and mainly because it had to do with women and children, I think, you know, because we think of, especially children, as innocent, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Tony, I think, too, you said something before we came on that people can't imagine. They don't understand. And I think, you know, we do live in this bubble, and first responders are very powerful people because we're placed in these situations that most people would think their life is worth more than that. They don't want to make those decisions. And in wartime, all the rules have changed. And that's what you just highlighted was normally, of course not. You were raised as a Catholic, even though you were a hunter, you saw the animal is very different than a human being. And as we should. But as we look during wartime, it's about survival. So it's you or them, and you are conditioned to always protect yourself and your crew like you do now with the fire department. But especially in wartime, you're in this fight or flight the whole time, right? Like you are fearful that at any time you could be attacked, and that has to change your brain, right? So you went from a normal life, a week later, you are thinking at any point I could die.
Right. Yeah, and those are the things that, you know, you bring back from the war. Because, you know, a lot of the things I noticed when I first came back was just that hyper-awareness, you know. And just that feeling of always being on edge, it took a long time for that to actually, you know, kind of dissipate over the years. And even still, you know, I walk into a crowd and it's like you scan the crowd. You know, you still have that hyper awareness and stuff, but
How much do you think it's aged you that, you know, 14 month deployment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at 25, I started greening up.
Oh, Silver Fox! Silver Fox!
Yeah, I can't blame it on my kids. You know, after the war is when the gray started popping out. I was pretty young then, so. You know, yeah, I tell people it's funny because you look at the presidency and you kind of look at first responders, same thing. They get in there, you know, dark hair, they come out and they're all grayed up.
That's true. It's true, for sure. Yeah, and then you have children, and then you're just instantly 100. So you experience this crazy wartime. You're in this war. You're immersed in it, and you carry a lot of the incidents home with you. So can you talk about how this affected your mental health in general when you were removed from the military?
Well, I'll say for the last about 15 years, I was in denial. I didn't think anything was wrong with me. You know, I came back, married my high school sweetheart. We had kids, bought our house. Got a good job with the fire department, you know. So, I mean, from the outside looking in, I was living the American dream. And, mm-hmm. You know, I had nothing to complain about. And I think people had seen little things in me, and you know, like my ex-wife tried to get me help at some point. You know, my parents did kind of push me to go to the EA and stuff, and I didn't see it. I felt normal. I didn't feel like there was anything wrong with me, you know. But obviously, they saw something or some sort of change. You know, the me before I went to war, the me that came back. Mm-hmm.
Were you married?
I think I was out 12 years. Was
that? Were you married when you were deployed?
No. That's another crazy story. I asked my girlfriend at the time to marry me, who was my high school sweetheart. 3 days after I asked her to marry me is when they called me and told me that I was being deployed.
Wow.
So our life got put on hold. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, coming out of the military, when did you actually accept that there's an issue here?
Yeah.
Well, I'll say before I had kids, there was a few times where I was just overwhelmed with everything. And I was actually, in fact, suicidal. You know, there was one night I kind of cut at my wrist. Another night I had gotten drunk and, you know, my wife found me in bed with my pistol. So, there's a few times, and I'll say that changed when I had kids. I was no longer suicidal per se. But one thing I learned later on was something called passive suicide, where you're not necessarily suicidal, but you'll do things knowing you're putting yourself in a position where you could get hurt or killed.
And speaking to that, that's like, you know, you're going into a fire. We had a gentleman named Mark Domingo that was talking about this in our prior episode, was he would go into a fire and want to get hurt, you know, something to happen. And I've been in that position for sure. Like, I've been in that mindset too, so I can definitely relate. Is that what you're kind of talking about?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I've had those same exact thoughts. And, you know, the other thing I would think about is my family, so my kids, you know, how that would affect them knowing that their dad had committed suicide or, you know, that kind of thing. So at least this way, if I did get hurt or killed, you know, I'd be a hero to my kids, you know.
Yeah.
So I did have those thoughts, yeah, you know, at times. But like I said, you know, even then I didn't even know the term passive suicide. So,
You said you've actually followed through and, you know, actually started taking action on it, which with, you know, cutting your wrists and whatnot. So where did it change for you to where it wasn't a thought, I'm going to do this? Like, what was there a significant thing that happened that just got you over the edge, or was it like a compound of things that basically compounded on each other to where you're like, okay, it's time?
Yeah, you know, I would have to say it was times in my life where I felt like my whole world was coming down around me. Like towards the end of my marriage, when my marriage was falling apart, if it was stressful stuff at work, when I just felt like everything was kind of coming down on me at once, those were the worst times, and those where I just, you know, I felt like I just couldn't do it anymore. That's what it changed. Like, when I had kids, because they were like my why, you know, my reason for pushing through and continuing and, you know, all that. But before then, you know, I would lose that. During some of the hardest times of my life, yeah, is when, you know, I would have those thoughts, and those few times I actually did take action on it.
So what happened with your relationships? Because usually when people are unaware that they have suffered a traumatic injury mentally, they usually have vices. So what did you turn to when your world was crashing down?
So I know we'll get into this later, but when I went to the IFF Center of Excellence, like I said, I was in denial and I didn't know what was going on with me. But knowing what I now know and looking back, my vice was kind of, I guess, I don't want to say women, but it's just that constant need to feel wanted and appreciated and like basically proud of. Because I think growing up, that learning, that's what I learned. You know, that early on, I come from a big wrestling family too. My dad and all his brothers, you know, were all state champs and stuff. So growing up wrestling, I always wanted to make my parents proud. You know, hunting, when I bring down my first, when I brought down my first deer, I've seen how proud that made my dad. That became addiction for me. And so constantly wanting to have people proud of me or, you know, that kind of thing, that became a kind of a sort of an addiction for me. So like when my marriage started failing, you know, and I wasn't getting that love and appreciation or that attention from my ex-wife, you know, I was finding it in the hospitals, you know, as a paramedic. Right? So, you know, I turned to alcohol early on when I first came back from war, and I kicked that pretty quick. But looking back, that's what became my vice, was just having to have that constant need, you know, or to feel wanted, so to say.
Yeah, and to that, I think that's a necessity that a lot of us first responders want. Like Zeph, when you were talking about wrestling, her husband Zeph was a part of Project Mayday. He was a huge wrestler.
Yeah.
I mean, he was also huge, but you know, when he talks about his wrestling and all that, and his dad, relationship with his dad, his tone changes. And I know, you know, she's picked up on it too. So it's a big thing to be wanted. I mean, for me, that's the whole reason I got into the fire service, was to be wanted. And the whole, you know, womanizer kind of aspect, Bree will happily tell everybody that I was definitely on that track, you know, with you. So it's not just you that's gotten that vice. There's a lot of people out there that just don't want to admit it, but you know, good on you and for realizing and calling yourself out.
So then what happened where you can be so transparent about your mental health? Was there an incident or did you go anywhere where you were able to do this self-discovery?
So after my marriage had ended, you know, I kind of had very quickly moved into another one. And she was a nurse and we had a great relationship for about 5 years. And like that was probably my highest high. You know, I was happy. You know, things were working themselves out with the divorce, so I was getting my kids all the time. And at the time, life couldn't have been any better. So when that fell apart, you know, I completely fell apart. Spiraled out of control. And I was back on that road where it was just, it really compounded itself. And the way a therapist had explained it to me is, you know, my body recognizes that stress, or it's familiar, you know, and it kind of goes back to the war. So when, again, when I felt like my world was coming down around me, and I was really stressed to the max, I would get those reoccurring nightmares again that I had when I first came back from the war, or those night terrors and stuff, you know. So it really is a downward spiral. And the further I got down this hole, you know, the worse it got. And my best friend, who I had convinced to get on the fire department with me, were actually medic partners on a medic truck at the time. And he's an amazing guy. He's one of those guys that give you the shirt off his back, you know. But he had approached me, and he knew, he could tell when something was wrong with me or when I was kind of, you know, going out of control like this. And he had found out about this center. It's called the IFF Center of Excellence. It's specifically for firefighters. It's a mental health and kind of like rehab for, you know, drugs and alcohol and stuff too. But you know, we had a conversation, me and him, a real heart to heart, and I came to the realization that I had to do something. I was pretty much at the end of my rope, I think, at that time. And I think if he hadn't come to my rescue, who knows if I didn't be here. I mean, I was that out of control. Mm-hmm. I was hiding from my family because, you know, my family knew, you know, I wasn't answering the phone. They'd come to my house, I wouldn't be here. Again, I not necessarily turned to alcohol, but I was drinking a lot more than I normally do.
Mm-hmm.
Just doing really stupid stuff, you know, drinking and jumping on my Harley and going 100 miles an hour, you know, kind of stuff. Again, the path of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So within a couple of days, you know, our union paid for a plane ticket for me to fly out to Maryland. And, you know, at that point, I had realized where my life was headed. And I knew if I didn't do something that I was going to end up in jail or dead or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my wake-up call. So I agreed to go to the center. You know, when I got there, I jumped in the program 100% and gave it everything I had. Because in my mind, I knew if this didn't help me, if this didn't fix me, then I didn't think anything would.
Mm. So, you know, talking, switching kind of gears here, Tucson Fire, how have they responded to your mental health?
They really didn't know there was an issue. You know, it was all, I kind of internalized everything. And, you know, going back to where we were talking about the past of suicide and how, you know, you take unnecessary risks, they have the job, you know, when I would do those things, you know, the kind of respect and the accolades you get from that kind of reinforces those bad habits, you know, instead of making things worse. So I just got really good at what I do. But to answer that, you know, it wasn't until I admitted to having a problem, and I, you know how the fire department is, you know, rumors spread like wildfire. So rather than have people guess or make their own assumptions as to what was going on with me, you know, I kind of just threw it out there and told people, you know, that this was a problem I had. I've had it for the last 16 years. I didn't realize it, but that I was going to get help. So that's basically what I did, and it helped. I mean, I got a lot of really positive support from people. Even when I came back, you know, I had guys calling me up asking me about my experiences and wanting to know more about the center. So
that's amazing, man.
And that's also what we talk about with this ripple effect of Project Mayday, is because you know, you're this big alpha male, military, you know, your persona is I am unbreakable. And you've been in the fire department, you were really good at your job, and then you're like, hey, I'm going to go mentally take care of myself. And the ripple effect is, wow, if he can do it, maybe I can do it. So then they're questioning you on the success of the program. And I think that's what's really important, is that we're talking about you aren't unbreakable, that you are a human being. And so your experience at the IAFF Center of Excellence hopefully will impact other firefighters in, you know, military. They have their own benefits that we've highlighted, but I think it's really, really incredible that you were able to even say it before you went, like, I'm going to squash it now. And I'm telling you, I'm going to go take care of myself, which is also something first responders don't typically do. So did anyone else go to it?
Yeah, I think we probably put about 5 other firefighters from our department.
That's great.
That's amazing. So there's this one thing that you talk about. It's, you know, we have PTSD, mm-hmm. PTSI. However, now you talk about PTG. So, you know, post-traumatic growth. So what does that look like for you? Because you're in it right now, right?
Right. Yeah. So the way it was explained is, you know, they didn't like the term PTSD as a disorder. Because, like, for instance, like a seizure disorder, that's something you're going to pretty much live with for the rest of your life, right? The way they like to see it is, they would call it PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury, because you can heal from an injury. You know, some injuries heal stronger. So post-traumatic growth is when you've gone through something like this program, and you no longer exhibit the signs or the symptoms of PTSI or PTSD anymore, which is where I'm at.
So what goes along with that? Is it spending more time with your kids? Mm-hmm. Is it taking mm-hmm. the old lady out to dinner? Like what is PTSG? PTG.
it's like I said, I it's so hard to explain just because I feel like a huge weight has been lifted off my shoulders. You know, all that guilt I've carried around with me all these years is gone. Mm. You know, some of these stories more I never shared with anybody. My family, my closest friends, my ex-wife, and I never told those stories. I never shared those stories. It was kind of, I think I was ashamed of myself for some of the things that I was forced to do or did. Because I think I explained it to you like this, you know, where on the fire department, I'm going to these calls, these horrible calls, you know, with the intent to do good, to help out, to make a bad situation better. Whereas like the wartime stuff, you know, I was there, I did that, I hurt people. So that's the big difference for me between the two. So when I went to the center, you know, kind of, it was a little different for them because it wasn't necessarily the job stuff that was really messing me up. It was war stuff. Mm-hmm. And they're used to just dealing with firefighters, you know? So
you're like, hey, I got this whole other thing.
I'm a special breed.
and you know, I helped out a lot of guys there too that were going through the program because they would want to know more. They'd want to talk to me about the stuff. And be like, oh, you know, like, maybe I don't have it so bad. but you know, and it's crazy. Like the brotherhood's really alive out there. You know, I know. These guys are just really helping each other out there. And it's just set up like a real fire department. You know, you got firehouses, you have the living area with recliners, big screen TV, you have the dorm rooms, you know. But these guys, they say that the best therapy happens after 4 p.m. because that's when the guys get together and talk and stuff. Now, there's women there too, and sensei guys. I've made a lot of really lifelong friends in there too, you know.
That's awesome. And I think that's the most important is to, you know, share your story mm-hmm. so that if someone else is going through the same thing, they can relate to you and be like, hey, if that guy can do it, just like Bree said, if that guy can do it, I can do it.
And, you know, Tony, if anyone was listening who has been kind of where you've been or is starting as a first responder, starting military, what advice would you give them?
Oh, man. I've been asked that before, and that's kind of rough because, you know, thinking back to the academy and stuff, they don't prepare you for what you're going to see or what you're going to go through and that kind of stuff. And even, I remember one of the first really bad calls I had as a firefighter, you know, I was on probation. We went to this MVA and a drunk driver hit these two girls in the Grand Am. And the car was just completely engulfed in fire when I got there. It wasn't until I put it out that I realized that two girls had burned up in that car. Even at the time, that was, 16 years ago, and there was no kind of debriefing or anything like that, you know? It's tough to give advice on, you know, like what we can do to prepare people for what they're going to see or do on the job or even in the military, you know? Because the truth is, you're probably going to see some horrible stuff in your career, you know. So how do you prepare for someone for that, you know, mm-hmm. until they actually experience it for themselves? I think that's where we kind of fail a lot of people coming into the job, you know, is not preparing them for that. But how do you prepare for that?
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. No, for sure. Dude, I can't even. Yeah. You got so much, buddy. We can go on and on and on. Like I said, part 30, part 40. I think to sum it up for you, it's ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Yeah. And you live that. You embody that, man. And I really appreciate you coming on. You don't get off that easy, though. We do have this next little bit. It's called Rapid Fire, buddy. You ready?
So the rule is, it's you answer in one word or one phrase. There's going to be five questions. Bree will ask them, and we'll see what you come up with. All right?
Oh, yeah. All right.
Okay, Tony. Number one, if you were a villain in a movie, which villain would you be?
I have to say the Joker.
Yeah, my God.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Okay, second question.
Wait, hold on. Which Joker, though? Oh. Heath Ledger or Joaquin Phoenix?
Oh, man.
That's hard.
I don't like Heath Ledger.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I kind of agree.
Yeah.
Okay, second question. What was your very first job?
My very first job? Oh, man. I was a laborer for my dad doing stucco and plaster. Oh, working in the sun.
Yeah, that's how you got, that's how you're, you know, you're all muscular now.
Okay, third question. What is your best pickup line?
Ooh.
Oh, man. I don't know how to pick up mine. I can maybe come up with something.
Is your pickup line, man, I'm a paramedic? Firefighter?
Oh, man. I'm brain fart.
It's all right. We'll let you slide on that one. That's what we
gave
you.
We know, obviously, that you can get people to marry you, so you have to have a pickup line, and you have a bunch of kids, so you're successful. We're going to let that one go. Fourth one, what is a quality that you value in people?
I'd have to say honesty.
Honesty? Yeah.
Okay, and last question. What is one word to describe yourself?
Fun.
I can roll with that one. I can roll with that one, definitely. On that note, Tony, it has been absolutely fun to have you on. I know the stories are, emotional and deep. However, it is fun to look back and see what you've been through.
Yeah.
Like I said, ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and you definitely encapsulate that. So thank you so much again, Tony, for coming on. Definitely love to have you back, buddy. And keep doing what you're doing, man. PTG.
I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. This is Project Mayday. Call out.
Call out.